At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the host of the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast and the founder of the Rise Above Justice Movement. Really quickly, I would like to state that viewer discretion is advised due to the nature of the topics discussed in this podcast episode. Today, I am joined by my friend Lauren, who is an incredible human being, survivor, advocate, and just somebody who's on the ground doing some very impactful work. And I would love to bring her on now to introduce herself. Lauren, welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm Lauren Lehman Carter, and it's just an honor to be here with you and to be in this movement, in this work alongside you.
Absolutely. You know, and this is a movement that is fueled with survivor voices, our allies coming together to end sexual and gender-based violence, but also focus on a lot of the issues that are going on in our country, across the globe, you know, internationally, and because it's all intertwined, it's all connected. And one thing that I would love to, you know, talk to you about, and we'll just dive right in, let's walk through a little bit of your story. You know, what inspires you to keep going? What inspired you to, you know, start your advocacy work, and just walk me through your journey?
Thank you for that question. It's been a journey, that's for sure. So my trauma background is I was in an abusive relationship when I was in high school, and I was sexually assaulted, raped, and unfortunately physically abused even on my high school property. So it was that, having that trauma at such a formidable age really shaped a lot of who I became as a young adult. I dove headfirst into perfectionism and people pleasing, and I became a wedding planner, because what is more perfectionist and people pleasing than planning weddings? And so I really poured myself into that. And then as an aside, I did start doing a little bit of advocacy more in a private scope. And I found myself volunteering for nonprofit organizations, donating goods and funds to women's shelters and organizations that really focused on some of these causes that are near and dear to our hearts. But I didn't really start using my voice publicly until it was Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, her testimony that really triggered me into finally actually processing what I had gone through and the way that it impacted my life. And so I started therapy pretty quickly after that recognition. There's a whole, I'm making it sound like it was some quick and easy, like, oh, I should probably get help for that. But we can talk about the reality of what that was later. And then at some point along the line, I ended up making my Instagram account private, and I would only share parts of my story within my circle of people, who consist of former clients of weddings I've planned and nonprofit orgs who I've volunteered for and friends and family. But I decided to take my account public just about a year ago. It was October of 2024, and so I'm less than a year into having a public facing Instagram account, and I'm trying to use my voice to advocate for empathy and humanity in all the different ways that we can. So, yeah, it's quite the strange path. I'm also no longer a wedding planner.
Are you able to talk a little bit about why you don't do wedding planning? Do you want to dive into that?
Sure. Yeah. There wasn't ever a moment where I was like, oh, I'm never taking another wedding again. I in January had two potential wedding clients who reached out to me, and I found that I was so immersed in what is happening in this political landscape. And really, it's beyond politics. I think it's more societal, and it's more universal than just focusing in on the politics of it. But seeing how things were evolving, even in January, I felt like I couldn't, with a good conscience, move forward in planning a wedding. Because planning a wedding, you're focusing on all of this energy you're putting into, okay, what color is your linen? And what about these beautiful flowers? And let's talk about fonts for your program. So just there, all of these little details that I used to absolutely love because it was a thing that I could hyper fixate on that felt safe and felt pretty. And I think at the time I thought it was healing, but actually it was a way for me to distract myself from some of the inner pain that I was navigating. So there was a moment where I had these potential clients, and I thought, you know what? I just, with the headspace I'm in right now, I'm not going to be able to give my best to a wedding where I'm going to focus all of my energy on their linen colors and their event design and the logistics of how we're moving people from one place to another. I would rather put that energy toward where do we need to go for a rapid response situation to protect some people, and how can I create content that resonates with people who might not really be paying attention otherwise. So it wasn't a choice, and it's not to say that I won't ever do another wedding again, because there's always going to be a place in my heart for those moments where we can celebrate love. But right now my head is really focused in this movement.
And you're also writing a book at some point too,
Yeah,
correct?
sure am. Yep, I need to get back into it. I've got about 90,000 words written, which is maybe more than
Which is
is.
incredible. That's 90,000 words of,
Yeah.
your voice and, your is this a personal book, like a memoir, or is
It
this
is a
more of
memoir. Yeah. I started writing it in May of 2023, and I got most of the writing done in those first 6 months. It was like it just was pouring out of me, and I couldn't stop it. I would be up all night writing. It was very cathartic. But then also, I am a writer. I had a blog for a little while. I have always loved writing. So I think that where it is right now, it's certainly not finished. I have a few chapters I need to write. It's easier to write about the pain and sort of to put yourself back into that trauma place than it is to write about the healing process, because the healing process is kind of vague. It's slow, and it's harder to track than these traumatic moments in life. So I'm working through writing the healing chapters. I've written the last chapter, so now I just need like a bridge. I need a few chapters to get me to the end. So my hope is to carve out a little time so that I can dive back into that. But it's definitely a something that even if I'm the only one that ever reads it cover to cover, it's deeply meaningful to me. And I hope that I hope that I can give a voice to other people who've experienced some similar things that I have.
During the 2024 election, there's a woman by the name of Erin Gallagher that I absolutely adore, absolutely love. She did Hype Women, and she just wrote a book that's getting ready to come out, and the foreword is done by Jamie Lee Curtis, and it's called Hype Women: Breaking Free from Mean Girls, Patriarchy, and Systems Silencing You. In your experience, coming from trauma to advocate, survivor, like these identities, what has been your driving force? How do you turn your energy into something that is going to change the world? Because you are literally a catalyst for change. Looking through your social media, you've been on the ground, you've been going to protests, you've been advocating, you've been doing a lot of these things. What keeps you going?
Ooh, that is a beautiful question. And also, I'm going to immediately need to add that book to my cart.
I highly recommend it. Yes.
That sounds spectacular. What keeps me going? There are definitely days where I feel like I can't go and I need to slow down and I need to rest. So I think recognizing those moments and letting myself be slow when I need to be slow. Maybe that's okay. Today I just need to be a mom. I need to just go sit in the grass with my kiddos and really be present. Sometimes it's that. Sometimes it's like this morning. Today's kind of a, it's been an interesting day for me. And I'm feeling kind of like a human today for the first time in several days. I've really been struggling. And so I said, okay, I'm gonna have a little ritual here. And my ritual is I will make myself a little pot of tea. I love loose leaf Earl Grey tea. And then I'll put some honey into my little teacup, and I'll just make myself a pot of tea and I'll just sip my tea. And it feels very ritualistic and grounding. So I did that this morning, and it's the first time I've made myself a pot of tea in probably a month, which I usually do it multiple times a week, but I've noticed that I've sort of gotten away from myself. So I think there's that permission to connect with myself and feel grounded and make sure that my nervous system is okay. That is paramount to continuing to go, but then I think the other end of that spectrum is I can't turn it off. I want to turn it off. I have tried to turn it off, but I have this drive to I ah, gosh, I don't even know how really to put this into words. It just feels like this moment that we're in is it can be so overwhelming and so intimidating. And I think, okay, if I can go out and I can record myself smiling and showing that, okay, we can still, this is how we can do this, and this is how we can come together, and there's unity, and there can be joy in moments of trial, and we can do this in a way that is hopeful. And sometimes I'm exhausted and I'm like, I can't go to another protest. But the second I get headed that way and I turn on a playlist, then I'm locked in. And it's like, I just can't turn it off. Music, I would say, also is huge. I'm a big music person. Right now, I would like to drop a little, like my current hyperfixation song is Olivia Dean, The Man I Need. It is such a bop. It is the best time to just dance around and you kind of get your body moving in a way that doesn't feel like you're on the defense. It doesn't feel like a protective kind of thing. It just really opens you up. So I'm a big fan of music.
Oftentimes we hear a lot about self-care. Music can be absolutely a form of self-care. And the decolonization of self-care is so incredibly important. You know, going back to the roots of self-care, you know, recognizing how those structures were overcame with like capitalism, racism, patriarchy, you know, co-modified those wellness practices and a number of other things. What is your ideas, you know, for decolonization of self-care? And then let's also jump into the dehumanization of sexual assault survivors after the trauma and, you know, the stigma behind coming forward, especially if you're coming against, you know, a really high-powered person, you know, that has like community influence, you know, thinking about like the Jeffrey Epstein survivors or thinking about Harvey Weinstein or thinking about, you know, you mentioned about Dr. Christine Blasey Ford earlier, you know, and that started a whole nother movement of people coming forward, you know. So what's your thought about the decolonization of self-care and like that dehumanization? And we'll do a deep dive into dehumanization here in a second, but let's start with the decolonization of self-care. What's your thoughts?
We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience, with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's Upwork.com. Upwork.com.
This is such a, and I love that we're talking about it live right now, and I didn't Google it or come up with a pre-canned answer because I just think this is such a fascinating conversation. So as far as decolonizing that healing experience and self-care and wellness, one of the things that I find myself doing, and I have a friend I will talk to about this, where, for example, one of the things that I was feeling recently was a lot of shame, like a lot of really dark, ugly shame. And I was talking to a friend and she paused me and she goes, "Remember, shame is how white supremacy functions. White supremacy and the patriarchy, they are built on making you feel shame. Like that is how it stays alive." So I think having conversations with people who are willing to step into a deeper level of what the meaning behind things are, like that, to have my friend call out to me that what I was feeling was actually a function of white supremacy felt so powerful, because then it's easier for me to identify and constantly deconstruct within myself, how have I internalized these things that I abhor? I abhor white supremacy and I abhor the patriarchy, but it's in the water that I swim in. If you tell a fish, I've used this analogy a few different times, but if you tell a fish who's swimming in polluted water that the water they're swimming in is polluted, and that if they just go upstream, if they just go, or if they go this direction, if you just modify, there is clean, fresh water over here, but the water you're in right now is polluted. That fish in the polluted water doesn't realize that they're swimming in polluted water because it's all they know. It's just water to them. They don't realize that there is something fresher and clearer somewhere else. So we all swim in that polluted water of white supremacy and patriarchy and colonization. Like that is what we swim in. So it's this constant practice of examining how has that played a role in the practices that I do. And I think also from a healing perspective, I am really drawn to following people in the therapy community and people in wellness who are women of color specifically. I just think it's really important that as white women, we don't think that we're the white saviors who are like, I've got wellness figured out. Come follow me. No, I think that the women that we should be following are the ones who have generationally been doing this work on a really deep level, because that's something that I just think it's important to have an understanding of. I don't know if this at all answered that question about decolonization of self-care, but would love your thoughts.
So I think you hit home, for a lot of different reasons. And no, it absolutely does answer the question 100%. And it goes even deeper than what I anticipated and even thought about whenever asking that question. And whenever I ask a question, sometimes I think to myself, like, should I have asked this in this way, or should I have, like, amplified it a little bit more? Should I have put like a more of like that, that human approach to it? But you did it, and you answered that question in such a way that I didn't anticipate, and I was really excited. And one of the other things that I think about is the individualism versus community. The individualism is like this luxurious, like, commodity, and you make self-care essentially primarily accessible to non-marginalized communities, right? Like going to Starbucks and grabbing, a pumpkin spice latte. Don't get me wrong, I absolutely love pumpkin spice, but at the same time, I see that as a luxury item whenever my mom needs, headache medication, right? So, and that's not a lie. And oftentimes, putting that community approach to it versus the individualism aspect, whenever you hear individualism versus community, what is your reaction to that? Because that's literally the direct colonization of self-care, but also getting into consumerism and contributing to that patriarchy, the white supremacy, and the dehumanization of us as a society. What is your thought on that? This is a very deep question.
I love it though. It's so good because no, you're absolutely right. That consumerism piece, and that I think ties into the way that perfection is drilled into us, especially white women. We are given this model that we should follow through perfectionism and people pleasing, and consumerism is part of that. It is. Am I wearing the right thing for the right themed party? Is it the right? Is it on trend? Is it current? Is it this? What does my house look like? How about this? What like? And it's this constant cycle. And I gotta tell you, when I left the wedding industry for all intents and purposes, I freed myself from a lot of that pressure because there was a lot of pressure of, well, nobody's going to hire me, or I'm not going to be trustworthy as a design professional if I am not constantly on trend with my fashion and with my home and showing pictures of that like that. And when I stopped, I can't tell you how freeing it is to not have to buy a cocktail dress every quarter. And it's the silliest thing, but it is that consumerism piece too, feeds into everything. But going to individualism versus community, again, I think that is it's all so connected. And through trauma, where I have felt most vulnerable in a painful way, not vulnerable like I'm sharing my story and I'm feeling supportive. That's a different kind of vulnerability to me, but vulnerability in the sense that I'm exposed and there are a lot of people that might want to cause me additional harm or are causing me additional harm and I don't have the support that I need. That has been from an individualistic sense of living in the world. It's people who are afraid of stepping into something painful or something dark. So you end up feeling lonely, so lonely that you can't function. Whether that is recovering from sexual assault or if it's something else, even new mothers. I mean, the loneliness that new mothers feel because we've lost that sense of community and the village. And I mean, I just remember when my babies were babies, I really struggled. I was alone. I was calling lactation consultants, begging for help through tears, and then also trying to plan a wedding and talk to a bride about her coral linens and which shade of coral is best. And it's just this isolating experience because colonization has really like pushed this rugged individualism, and so it's disconnected us from our neighbors, from our family even. I mean, I am so disconnected from so many family members for various reasons. And my like next door neighbors, it just, and it's, I think it comes down to that sense of rugged individualism, which has landed us in a whole lot of, I just opened up a whole other can of worms with rugged individualism here. I didn't even get to the other part of the question about the dehumanization. So I don't know if we want to kind of regroup on that,
I
but.
think this is a direct, a direct correlation into the dehumanization that survivors face whenever they come forward with a number of, different, stories, right? And thinking about the blaming and the shaming and the dismissing, the discrediting, and the invalidating, feedback towards that survivor, but also thinking about the impact on survivors, like the reinforcing of the trauma, retelling their stories numerous times. I know there's oftentimes that I tell my own story that I do end up triggering myself, but I've come to, I've overcome a lot of those barriers to the healing and then like the negative mental health act, outcomes, because according to the DSM and even like the new DSM-5, and all the other DSMs, CPTSD, complex post-traumatic stress disorder, is not currently recognized in the diagnoses, right? So those barriers, what can we do as a society to come together to believe when a survivor comes forward? What can we do to uplift them versus the perpetrator?
That's such a good question. And I also love that you called out that CPTSD is not recognized. That's why my diagnosis right now is PTSD. And my therapist has told me that if there was a like in the DSM-6, like if that were to add complex PTSD, that would be more appropriate for me as a diagnosis. But yeah, I think the thing that I keep thinking of as we talk is I don't think it's that people are inclined to isolate and dehumanize survivors. I think it's that they're scared because what we have faced as survivors is so unimaginable to a lot of people, and yet there are so many of us. I think that they're scared. I think it is terrifying, especially if it's a loved one, to hear. I mean, I remember the first time I told my dad about what happened, and it was years after the fact. And I told him by way of I had written something for a college course that I was taking, and I wrote this really powerful thing that I did as a spoken word presentation for my final project. And I read it to him first. And that was how I told him what. And he knew that I had been through something really awful. He just, I don't think, understood what specifically. And I could see his heart breaking as I told him. I think it's a really scary thing to know that a loved one, especially somebody who feels a sense of protection over you, I think that's really scary. And so I think that then you end up in a situation where people are paralyzed by fear and they just don't know what to do. So they don't even want to talk to you at all because it's terrifying. What if they say the wrong thing? It would just be easier to be quiet. And then that silence opens up this chasm for people who do have malicious intent and who do want to dehumanize survivors. That's the only thing that we hear if we are not hearing support from our loved ones. And then I think the people that do the dehumanizing intentionally, I think they're telling on themselves, frankly. I think if you hear people say that it wasn't really rape and that there's a gray area, or people like Brett Kavanaugh, like I think that it, like seeing them in, I mean, and Clarence Thomas, it's like we could just go down the whole list. And seeing these people in positions of power who have vehemently pushed back against the accusations, the credible accusations, and they're pushing back with such vitriol. I think they're just telling on themselves because that vitriol dehumanizes their survivor. And I think if you don't come to a situation like this with a sense of curiosity and trying to understand, like, tell me more. Like, I'm curious, what has this experience been like for you? What have you gone through? Why did it feel like that to you? Like, if you don't come to these situations with that frame of reference and you come to it more with a sense of absolutely not, like what was she wearing? She put herself in that position. She's lying. She's just looking for clout. If you come at it there, then you're telling on yourself. Like that's defensive because you've probably caused that.
Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haulaway, basic installation, parts, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Kind of harm, and you're recognizing a reflection in a mirror that doesn't sit well, so you get angry, and then it escalates.
Which we all know what happens whenever escalation, you know, continues going, the ongoing conflict, you know, not only with those around us but also within ourselves too, right? And totally. I want to recognize one of my favorite, you know, organizations, which is the Healing and See PTSD Foundation. They just created the CPTSD Alliance. And the Healing and See PTSD Foundation is a 501c3 founded by Danielle Carpio, an advocate dedicated to empowering survivors of complex trauma. They provide financial assistance and lead advocacy efforts for the recognition of CPTSD in the DSM and for trauma-informed policies across those key systems such as healthcare, education, and law enforcement, ensuring survivors receive the support they need. I love seeing movements like this because it's so incredible to see. And if you think about it, everything that's going on in our communities is all connected. And we're seeing it on the news. We're seeing it with the Jeffrey Epstein survivors. We're seeing it with the Trump administration. We're seeing it with a number of these huge, you know, big political players, right? But we also have really critical elections that are happening across the country. I mean, look at New York City with Zohran Mamdani going against Andrew Cuomo, who has been proven as a sexual abuser, right? Mm-hmm. How do we recognize that, and how do we overcome putting these people on that pedestal?
Oh, that's the million-dollar question. I mean, I think it starts in the discourse that we're having now, and I think that that's rooted in what I'm trying to do with my social media platform. And it started out where I did talk about my PTSD and I did talk about my sexual assault privately. when my account wasn't public. And I also talked about it when I was public for a few years with my blog. But I think that I try to put a face to what this experience is. And whenever I post something, I am always crafting it from the lens of what do I want the people in my life to know about my experience? Because a lot of the people in my life have not asked me questions, don't really want to talk about it, don't know the details. And I think it's because they're afraid, and I think it's too painful. So it is not a thing. There are strangers out there that I have never met who know more about my trauma than my family. And so I think that sometimes I'm crafting these posts specifically talking to the people in my life about what I want them to know. And through that, I'm finding other survivors are like, yeah, exactly. I want people to know that about me too. And then they share it. And so I think it's sharing our stories in a way that tells the people in our lives, this isn't just a vague statistic. These are people who you know and who you love. And this is actually what living with that is like. It is a thing that will haunt me forever. And I have to know that those ghosts are there and know how to navigate it and how to move through the world with ghosts. And I think doing it in secret is how shame develops. And my therapist says the antidote to shame is exposure. So that's what I do almost every day with my platform is I expose something about myself. And I usually, if I'm feeling shame about something, I will say it out loud to however many thousands of people are following me. And it's terrifying, but it feels like a relief. Like I just posted a reel last night about a really scary traumatic situation that I've been navigating, by receiving death threats and being doxxed. And it's the kind of thing that might make other people shut down their accounts and go private. And that was the advice I was given. But I decided instead I was going to expose the things that were making me feel scared. And somehow today I feel like I can actually exist without the same level of fear and shame that I was carrying. Like I was feeling shamed. I was feeling ashamed about receiving death threats because it was like, well, I put myself out there on the internet and people know my name and I didn't disguise myself. So I'm easy to find. And now this is happening. And I felt so much shame about it. But again, remembering that the shame is actually a function of white supremacy because they want us to stay quiet and they don't want us to talk about the things. And the they I'm saying is generally speaking, the people who benefit from white supremacy. Like the function of white supremacy is to keep you ashamed, to keep you quiet, keep you compliant. So anytime I feel that, I'm just pushing through it and posting it to the internet, which is a choice.
But you do it in such a phenomenal way that brings people together, you know, and I commend you on, you know, the advocacy that you're doing. You know, turning rage into passion, turning that passion into helping other people overcome their own trauma and build that sense of community, you know, which oftentimes is what a lot of survivors are really looking for, is just that sense of community and feel like, okay, I'm going through some rough shit, but how do I find other people that are also going through it too? And that's part of why I created the Rise Above Justice movement too, was to bring people together. And, you know, we're almost at 200,000 followers on social media, which is literally mind-blowing, right?
It's amazing.
And you've been following us for a really,
for
a very long time.
I don't even know how long I've been following you, but I think I remember when we started actually interacting, I was like, oh my God, they know who I am. Amazing. Because your work is so impactful.
I remember that message. You're like, wait, you want to collaborate with me? Like, you want to collaborate with me? And then
exactly.
Look at what you've done just in that, you know, that short amount of time. And your social media, you know, you're very empathetic. You know, it's literally in your tagline. Kids used to call me Loudmouth Lauren, like it's a bad thing. Empathy advocate, writer, mom, essay survivor, event planner. Like, these are all incredible, you know, labels, if you will, you know. But outside of the labels, you know, what are you currently working on? What are you currently, you know, we focused on where you were. We focused on what you were doing during that. Let's focus on where you're headed now. What's next for Lauren? You know, as you stated, you want to jump back into, you know, writing again and doing some more like work on your book. But what's next for you?
That is such a great question. I say to a friend, I've been saying it since 2023 really was a pivotal year for me, because that's when I decided to start writing my book. And that's when I started feeling kind of disillusioned with the wedding industry. And wanting to focus my event work more on my nonprofit clients, which is kind of tricky because the weddings, I can charge my full price. But with nonprofits, there's a nonprofit rate. And sometimes it's just a straight up, I'm volunteering. I'm not even charging anything. So that structure that helped me pay my bills doesn't exist anymore in the way that it did before. So I need to start kind of thinking about how to make advocacy something that I can do in a full-time capacity, because I really feel like there's an impact here that a lot of us together are making, and I want to continue doing that. So I'm starting to think about what that looks like, but really the friend that I referenced, I say in 2023, since then I have been saying the path will become clear. The path will become clear. Like, I don't know what the path is, but it's going to become clear. And I've started to actually pivot that phrase, because it's not so much that the path will become clear. It's that I'm making the path. The path isn't there and I'm making it, and you're making it, and we are all creating paths forward, and hopefully all of those paths converge in a way that makes our entire community that much stronger. So I think I've got a lot of vulnerability, supported vulnerability right now, where I don't really know what's next, and I'm just trying to be open to whatever is coming down the pipeline. I have been, I've recorded 2 episodes of a podcast with my friend, Michelle, who is based in California, and our podcast is called Burnt. We haven't released it yet, but we've got 2 in the can, and we are planning to tease it and release it this week, but I've been apprehensive about doing it because of the death threats in the last week. I wanted to kind of pump the brakes there, but so who knows where some of these things will go. I love speaking. I love telling my story. I love connecting with others. There was a moment where I really considered running for state senate and went down that whole exploratory route for several weeks. It was about 6 weeks of investigating, and I decided right now is not the time for me to run for office. It's not the right time for my kids, but I want to figure out how I can, now that I've decided not to run for office at this moment, what can I do with my voice and with this community that I'm building and building with others? What can I do with that still makes an impact, just like how I would have been able to make an impact if I had been able to run and get elected to office? What are other ways that I can use my voice to have an impact. So definitely still figuring out what that path looks like.
Yeah, you know, and I think it's perfectly perfectly okay to recognize that, you know, while we don't know what path is going to open up, because it can go in a lot of different directions, right? Because we understand by navigating the systems, we know about different paths, you know?
Totally.
But I think, you know, one of the things that we focus a lot on is, you know, coming forward as survivors. And that brings me to my last question for you. And the last question for you is, if you were messaged on Instagram or Facebook or, you know, any other social media platform, and a survivor is looking for help navigating the system, you know, trying to tell their story or report to police, what advice would you give to them and why?
Well, that has happened. I think the situations vary. One situation in particular, somebody who I know lives in my general community, but didn't know in real life, reached out, and her situation was active. It was an active, abusive SA situation, and kids were involved, and so we talked, and I, from getting that information, of what she was navigating, I encouraged her to definitely continue with therapy and to maybe increase the level of therapy she was getting. I don't think that the therapist that she had initially was the right fit for her. But then, like we talked about before we started recording, therapy is, there's a threshold of accessibility to that. Not everybody has therapy easily or financially accessible to them. So that was my first direction. If at all possible, therapy. I have been in therapy since December of 2018. And I have family who say, well, haven't you been through enough therapy? Aren't you done yet? But navigating PTSD is an ongoing thing. That's not something that goes away. It's not like a one-time situational thing. So I also am a big fan of journaling and processing my feelings through writing. So whenever I don't have access to a therapist, I love to journal. And I find it really cathartic to even be able to name the feeling I'm having and then unravel where that feeling came from. And so now I think I have a pretty heightened awareness of the subtext behind. Like, I know exactly why I had a panic attack at my kid's soccer game on Saturday and then came home and immediately started throwing up. Like, I know that that was because I had a spike in adrenaline and I could recognize the things that I was concerned about, but my body was like, nope, you can't rationalize this. We're going to panic. And there's a team of tigers chasing you. So I think I have only gotten to that point to be able to cognitively understand what's happening. And then when I cognitively understand it, I can take my emergency anti-anxiety medication, lorazepam. I can pop one of those pills if I feel a panic attack coming on. I can get grounded. I can put my feet in the grass. I can look at my hands and I can say, these are my hands right now. These are my feet right now. I am safe in this moment. There is nobody coming to get me, and I can breathe and I can do my box breathing. I love box breathing or seven breaths. I don't know if you are familiar with either of those. The box breathing is you envision a box and a line being drawn to make that little box, and you breathe in for four and then hold it for four and then out for four and hold for four and repeat. And the whole time it's kind of drawing a box in your head. Or seven breaths for the count of seven. And I'm gonna breathe in for seven, breathe out for seven, and do that seven times. So sometimes, like if I'm in a really activated state, I can get myself back down to a neutral nervous system, but I have to know that that's what's happening. There are a lot of times where I don't know that's what's happening. And so I think for survivors, being able to really get introspective with yourself and understand what does it feel like when you're triggered and what was happening in your surroundings when you were triggered. And I personally like to write about that. And I can write it out, and that helps me identify it. So then I know the next time that starts to happen, I'm able to identify it, and then I'm able to apply my coping strategies, my tools, if you will. And then I also encourage reporting, and getting, especially if it's something that's ongoing, I think that reporting is important, whether or not it's going to move forward to a trial or charges. It might just be that your voice reporting somebody who's done something awful is the reason that charges are pressed on a different case with that same perpetrator. So I think it's important that we, when we can, that we do report, because the impact is bigger than our own case. And that's something that I know to be true, that they hold on. They will hold on to your case. And if somebody comes later and reports that same person, then there's a history. So I really like to advocate for survivors to build community, to get therapy, to work within themselves on identifying the triggers, have safe places where you can come up with strategies that work for you, and report if it's applicable, to report somebody. I have only ever reported once, and I have been, there are three people who have sexually assaulted me, and I have only ever reported one of them. So, and I guess they're now, even just saying that out loud, I've got shame popping up. Three different people. That feels like a lot, and it's not something I say very often. But when you've been sexually assaulted once, you are statistically more likely to be sexually assaulted in the future. And it's part of that trauma response, that fight or flight. Your body kind of knows to shut down or to like whatever your trauma response is. But you're more likely to be in that situation again. Gosh, even the wording there in that situation, it's not putting yourself in the situation. See, this is a thing. I've been in therapy since 2018, and I still struggle with the stories that I tell myself because of the shame that society has told me is mine to carry. But it was never our shame to carry. It is the shame of the people who think that it makes them more powerful. And that they can control other people's bodies. And that is not our shame to carry. Gosh, what a journey of an answer that was.
And that is exactly the point of the podcast, is to understand the complexity of the issues that surround us and the things that survivors go through literally as they're telling their story or answering a question. And I'm glad that it happened in real time. And I firmly believe in the authentic and real conversation versus what a lot of other podcasts do. They'll go through, they'll water it down, they'll edit it, they'll do things. I believe in the raw authentic conversation, because it brings a human approach and the humanistic side of being a survivor versus being scripted versus being, you know, this watered down, whitewashed bullshit of a podcast. And I'm not, you know, naming specific podcasts. I'm speaking in the general term. I'm not calling anybody out, but there are certain journalists and certain podcasters that do like to whitewash it and water it down. I am not like that. I believe in the authentic voice that is presented in front of me. You know, I invited you onto this podcast because I saw the human side to you, because there's more to you than just these labels, right? And, you know, Lauren, I want to thank you for the work that you do, for being, you know, bringing your whole self to every situation that you are in. You know, being authentic is a part of shattering the patriarchy. I know people don't like it, but at the same time, we got to do what we got to do to continue pushing forward as a society, as a survivor community, because ultimately, if we don't do it, nobody else is going to do it for us. If I do not share these stories, who's going to share them? The mainstream media is complicit in silence, and our politicians continue to fail us. They do not believe survivors. They do not listen to survivors. And I am committed to sharing the stories that others will not. And with that, Lauren, thank you so much for coming on to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. To anybody out there who is listening, please be sure to subscribe to our podcast, uplift Lauren's voice, uplift our other survivor voices who are coming onto the podcast and bravely sharing their stories. And with that, stay tuned for more episodes. Thank you so much, Lauren.
I appreciate you. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.